be spoken to in the depths of our hearts. Amen. This morning, our story is from the book of Job, which is not a book we preach from terribly often in our churches. Perhaps a verse in chapter 19 of Job, "I know that my Redeemer lives," is one that just truth tellers who try to draw attention to God and point to some kind of moral order to the universe are condemned for their empty piety. There must have been some kind of committee once, some kind of class group or subcommittee, which was tasked with working out if Job should actually be included in the Bible. There would have been much vexation over this problematic book from devout and religious men. And if there had been a Tascam recording of that meeting, you might have heard something like this. "We know that people are sarcastic, and we cannot have sarcasm, and we cannot have this book." And then another point in the recording: "People have too much hatred. There is too much hatred in this book. Begone with it." Another might have said, "There are people who are atheists, and we don't want to give them any encouragement. Let's not include this book. There can be no place for doubt in the church." Other people: "Nihilism is the empty philosophy of the German philosophers who proclaim there is nothing. And here is a man blessed for his nihilism. We cannot have this book." And then somebody: "There is bitterness in this book, and we can't allow people to be bitter. Begone with the book." And then in that meeting, the wind of the Spirit must have blown, because they said yes to the book of Job. Maybe it was that those who had screeched against the book were made to realize that their sarcasm was given a voice in this book, so it could be brought and be healed. They were realized that they too, though they condemned hate, were also given to hate. That though they poured scorn on atheists, they too had many doubts. Though they hated the German nihilists, they had to concede that sometimes they agreed with them. And yes, they too were bitter. And so that committee, listening to the Spirit of God, decided that if faith is to be honest, then it must refer to the book of Job. That they did no good by uttering religious pieties about a God who is not there. And instead, we must have faith in the God who is. The story begins with a blameless, upright man, Job, the greatest of all the people in the East, we are told. Yet this did not make him arrogant, his wealth. He was religiously devoted, humble, kind, and generous. And then there appears in heaven a figure who makes his first appearance, named at least in the scriptures. He is called the Satan, which is not a name, but more a role, which means the accuser or the prosecutor. And he appears in heaven dripping with sleek resentment and irrefutable analysis and hatred towards Job, which is really hatred towards God. And he says, "In this world," he says, "there are only mutually beneficial contracts, trade deals, we might say, but never love." And he says, "Look at Job. He's only been nice to you, God, because you're nice to him. Take that away and he'll condemn you." So God says to Satan, "Okay, you can take away everything he has." God allows that to happen and Job loses his family and his possessions. But still he holds out. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The Satan is not finished. Of course, Job's fine, he sneers. Touch someone's relatives and property and you're not really hurting them, he claims somewhat falsely. Skin for skin, take everything, harm his body, and he will abandon you, O God. So Job is afflicted with boils. And this time Job's wife turns on him. You idiot, she says to him. Curse God and die. But Job's piety is unflinching. Shall we receive good from God and not receive evil, he says. And in this we are told Job did not sin with his lips. And then friends appear. Good friends. And they sit silently for 7 days. And for whatever will be said of the friends later on in the book, we must realise that these people are good therapists, sitting in silence for 7 days. And eventually, at the end of 7 days, Job's dam bursts. And he says, cursed be the day that I was born. Cursed be that of days, because it had one job to do that day. It had to prevent my mother's womb opening up. It had to stop me coming into the world. And I was brought into the world. May the name of that day be blackened. May that day be taken out of all the calendars. May the people who curse days, apparently in those days there was a job of cursing days, may the people who curse days curse that day. Eliphaz the Temanite, his friend, goes for an easy option. Just blame yourself, Job. Just accept that you've sinned and all will be well. So often people have said to victims, it's your fault. Job is having none of it. I'm not going to invent a sin, he says. Rather, I'm going to tell you how sore all of this is and how much is the extent of my calamity. Bildad the Shuhite comes back, and these are long speeches. If it's not you, he says to Job, blame your kids. Always blame your kids. Anyone goes missing in your house, blame your kids. Job says, no, my real opponent is not my children. My opponent is God. And I am going to pick a fight with God and I'm going to lose. But I'd rather lose in a fight with God than have a fight with someone whose fault this isn't his. Then the friends come back. And Job says some very profound words. He says, if I forget my complaint, if I put off my sad face and wear a smile, then I will become afraid of my suffering. Isn't that very profound? If I put away my sadness and wear a smile, I become afraid of my suffering. The sense seems to be that we will suffer. But Job is aware that there is somehow a choice and reaction to this suffering. Is this suffering to somehow be held and to be settled with and to be known, or something that is to be run away from? And if you run away from it, you're building that fear. Zophar the Nethamite comes back. Oh, this is babbling, he says. Job, you're mad and we're the experts. How often have experts tried to silence people and tell them that they were mad? Job comes back with sarcasm. Now, for those of you who for your whole lives have been told that sarcasm is the lowest form of wit, this verse in the Bible is for you, because sarcasm is blessed. And if you like using sarcasm, then you're allowed to be a friend of Job. Because he turns to his friends and he says, oh, is wisdom going to die with you, is it? So he's implying that when three of you die, all wisdom in the world is going to be gone. I suppose that's what's going to happen, he says, sarcastically. His friends come back, Eliphaz. You're full of wind and emptiness. And I feel sorry for Job here, pouring out his heart, and he's told simply that he's full of wind. Have you ever poured out your heart to someone and they just haven't treated what you said seriously? This goes on for another 20 chapters, because suffering is never short. And then God comes in chapter 38, not to tell Job that his religious friends are right, not to offer Job much sympathy, it has to be said, But instead he bombards Job with questions. Do you know the source where light comes from? Who is this that darkens my counsel? Do you know the cornerstones of the world? Do you order the dawn of the morning? Have you seen the storehouses of the snow? Have you seen that the crocodile cannot be tamed? This is slightly bizarre. Job has rage and pain and screeching and agony, and it is met with a David Attenborough documentary. Then God restores Job, gives him back his possessions, gives him daughters, but before he had sons, and they are called names like Ruby and Jasmine and Perfume, and they bless Job all the rest of his days. So what do we say about this story? The first, I think, is to say that honest utterance, authentic voicing of who we are, is healthy. To protest is healthy. Robert Davidson, professor of Old Testament in Glasgow and former moderator, used to say his favourite verse of the whole Bible was Job chapter 41, verse 7, which says to Eliphaz the Temanite, "My anger burns against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." So remember, the friends were all the time uttering religious pieties and telling them that God was going to make everything and that Job had just sinned and he just needed to confess his sin and all would be fine. And Job was saying, "I haven't sinned and I haven't made a mistake here and God's my opponent and I'm fed up with a lot of you." And God turns not to the religious people and says that they've done wrong, but to Job, the guy who's been crying out. God asks of us simply our honesty. Do not utter with the voice that you think your religious upbringing told you to have. Do not utter with the easy way that blames yourself. Too often we just say, "Oh, it's my fault." Do not be deceived by those who, people like me, who have religious qualifications. Instead, utter truth from your being and keep digging and digging until you get to the point where you sense your brokenness and the redemption of God. To refuse to grieve, to suppress anger, to avoid shouting at heaven the things we mumble on earth, is to hold on to our fear and to keep God out. When bad things happen to good people, when the innocent are worn down, when we are cast into calamity, we must express our outrage to let God in. God is big enough to take the worst things we can say. The only thing God cannot stand is dishonesty. It tells us, this book as well, how difficult it is to sit with someone who is in pain. It is the hardest thing. These three friends are brilliant therapists. They sit with Job for 7 days silently, but even they get fed up in the end and start saying to Job, "Oh, Job, if you just do this, you'll be fine. Or Job, this must be your fault. Oh, Job, stop being so irrational. Oh, Job, stop cursing God. God won't like it." It's hard to be with someone in pain. I was once present as an accompanier when a friend of mine was in a session of therapy. And the friend of mine was saying to the therapist, and they were quite bleak, and they said, "Oh, everybody just hates me all the time." Now, the therapist is trained at this point to spot a thing that therapists call catastrophizing, or all or nothing thinking. It's when you say everything is so bad and it's all going to be a complete disaster. And what a good therapist will do is say, "Well, is everything bad, or is it just some of the things are bad? And are they a complete disaster, or are some things all right? And do you know it's going to be a disaster? And does everybody hate you, or is it just a few people?" So that's what the therapist is made to do, is kind of unpick that kind of all or nothing thinking. So the therapist turns to my friend and says, "Well, is everything really that bad? There might be times when you think to myself, 'Oh my God, everything is terrible,' and actually they're not." At which point, the individual concerned burst into tears and walked out the room. The therapist turned to me and said, "What happened there?" And I said to the therapist, "It might be because my friend is quite religious, And because you said, "Oh my God," that person might have been offended. The therapist was shocked at this lapse in professionalism. Of course she says, "I should have remembered that. I can't believe I said, oh my God." Eventually the person goes back into the room, sits down, a little bit calmer, and it's kind of a bit frosty, and I turn to the person and say, "Hey, could it be that Fiona, who's the therapist, could it be that you were upset because Fiona said, oh my God?" Friend turns around and goes, "No, I'm not bothered about that at all." "All right, what were you bothered about?" He said, "All the time, people keep telling me that things are not as bad as I say they are, but they are. And I get fed up with people telling me to look on the bright side. And I've had enough." And the therapist turned to my friend and said, "I believe you." And that was the point at which healing occurred. It is hard to sit with another person's pain. This book is about mysteries. It's really about three mysteries. The first is the mystery of suffering. The second is the mystery of life. That's what all these questions are about. When God comes and says, "Have you seen the crocodile? Have you seen the storehouses of grain? Have you seen the deep? Is it you that wakens up in the morning?" It's almost as if Job is forced to have a bigger context on his mystery. Not to erase the mystery of suffering, but to set it alongside another mystery, which is the mystery of life. The mystery of being. The mystery of breath. The mystery of why is it that we are all here. Yes, for people of faith, there is the problem of suffering, what's sometimes called the problem of evil. And there are no easy answers. But what sustains faith is another mystery. What on earth are we all doing here? How on earth did all that happen? And it's those two mysteries that the people of faith hold together. God does not confront Job with answers, but expands the scope of his questions. The third mystery is the mystery of God. Not the God who is made up, the mechanistic God who repays good for good and evil for evil, but somehow the God who is beyond us. If we had an easy, predictable God, there would be none of us and none of this. An easy, predictable God is called an idol. But our God is spirit, beyond our categories and our explanations, and beyond even our universe. And this is a story of Job being taken to a place beyond being naked. Everything stripped away on top of his skin, and everything stripped away under his skin. His spirit is broken. And in that desolate, godless hell, he meets God. We hit the depths and discover that God is there waiting for us. He proclaims that God is not in existence, and he meets God. This is the story of the mystery of God, the story of Good Friday, and the story of Easter. The God who meets us in the depths and promises that one day we will be lifted up. For everyone, the screaming, raw, atheistic doubter, and everyone else. In a moment we will eat the body which is broken. And remember that at the moment the body of Christ was broken, he cried words that could have been said by Job. My God, why have you forsaken me?" And we drink new wine, which is the new covenant, one with blood, with loss, on a journey to hell, so that heaven might one day be ours. We are blessed. There is the mystery of suffering. There is the mystery of life. And there is the mystery of God.